We're going to finish this book the next couple weeks here. And Zechariah chapter 9. We're going to look at one verse. But we're going to have to look at some other verses to explain that verse. But we're really looking at one verse. And so Zechariah chapter 9. So as you think about family, and you think about, I don't know what your family of origin is, but you know, what do brothers fight about? That's right, everything. I watch in our family. We have three brothers, and I watch, you know, Manny, Moe, and Jack, or Caleb, Andrew, and Ryan. I watch how they interact, and they can be harmonious one second, and that can change in a heartbeat. And for me, I didn't have a brother. I had a sister. I always wanted a brother. And so if I'm really to be honest, and Sarah would probably say, she's in the nursery this morning, there are times that there are four brothers in our house. And so we like to do those things. And so God is the creator of family. And in his perfect design, he puts someone in charge in the home, a man, a father. And the man has the responsibility and the accountability for leading our homes. But the man is not good enough to do it by himself. He needs help. And to be honest, no person is good enough. We all miss things. We've all stared at the refrigerator looking for something, and we can't see it, and someone comes by and says, the milk's right in front of you, Dad, or Mom, or whoever. We need to live in relationship to one another. And so we know God gave a woman to a man to be his wife. And together, Scripture says, they bear the image of God. Not alone, but together. And we know that we live in a broken world, and so we know that that's God's design, but we know that that doesn't always play out the way that we see. And so some of you, even in this room, might be, you know what, hey, I'm a single mom, or I'm a single dad, or I'm going through that. And so that's part of this broken world. And we know that it doesn't always work out perfectly. But God is a God of redemption, and God is a God of reconciliation. And God has put authority in the home. It's given by him. It's a good thing. And so within in the home, like if we don't submit to one another, things come unglued pretty quick, don't they? We just say, you know what, I'm going to do what I want today. Forget all of you. Things aren't going to go too well. And so we know that at a family level, and you zoom out to a community level, you zoom out to a national level, there still needs to be authority. There still needs to be order. And so Zechariah chapter 9 is instructing us in the midst of the nation of Israel that was in disarray, that didn't listen to God, that they were exiled for 70 years, and God was bringing them back because he is a covenant-keeping God. He doesn't give up. He takes us through hard times, but he also fulfills his promises. And so they are on the route back. But he also is giving them a picture of the future. And Zechariah 9:9 is a verse that, as we read it, you're going to be like, oh, I heard that a few weeks ago on the Sunday before Easter. I heard this verse. And I remember when the pastor said, in a few weeks, we're going to look at this verse in more detail. And we're going to do that this morning. And so look here in Zechariah 9:9. Let me read the verse. It says this, "Rejoice greatly, O daughters of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughters of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And so 500 years before Jesus Christ would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, God gives this word to the nation of Israel. It had meaning for what was going on right then, but it also had future meaning, but it also has future meaning even beyond Jesus' day. And so we're going to look at that. And so what does he say here in the beginning? He says, rejoice and shout. He's encouraging that, you know what, there is hope, Jerusalem. And again, remember, as they're hearing these words, they're looking, and the city is being rebuilt. The temple is being rebuilt. So they're not sitting here looking at a finished product. They're sitting here looking and saying, it's kind of a mess here right now. But God is reminding them, I'm not finished. I'm not done. And so that's why the encouragement here is rejoice and shout. He says here, Zion and Jerusalem. Zion is the spiritual description of the nation of Israel. Jerusalem is the physical description of the city that is the capital of Israel. And he's emphasizing the physical and the spiritual, because that's really a part of all of our lives, right? We have a physical component, but we also have a spiritual component. And so he's encouraging that. And so what does he say next? Here he gives them the hope. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he. Now, in their day, as they're hearing Zechariah say these words, who was the king, or who was the governor? Name the governor. Who was it? Anybody remember? Zerubbabel. Exactly. He was the physical person in charge. He was the king. Who was, we'll test you, who was the priest at the time? Joshua. Joshua was the priest. And so really this whole book is pointing to say God's plan involves a priest and his plan involves a king. Unlike any, those of you who are reading through the Old Testament, was there any perfect high priest? Was there any perfect king? No. And so we keep seeing one after another because everyone was pointing to not good enough, didn't do it. Even the best ones weren't up to par, because they're all pointing to there is only one true king who is righteous all the time. And so he's reminding us here. And so what is he, you know, look down at verse 9. Behold, your king is coming to you. And so what does this king do? This king is going to be like any other king. He is righteous. And again, we've talked about this when we looked at Psalm 1 and 2, which describes this. Righteousness is not a 70%. Well, I'm 70% righteous, so I'm pretty good. No, righteousness is 100 or zero. It's all or nothing in God's economy. And so this king is going to be righteous. Not he gets it right 90% of the time. No, this king, he is completely righteous, 24/7, all the time. Every decision, every manner, every word, he is righteous. And what does this king do? It says here he has salvation. Having salvation is he. He's bringing salvation. And so the natural question is, if this king is coming bringing salvation, what do we need saved from? What does humanity need to be saved from? Well, if we're honest, we all want to be our own king. if we're really honest, we're naturally more interested in building our kingdom than submitting ourselves to the lordship of Jesus Christ and building his kingdom. And that's what we need save from. We need save that we want to do our own thing. We want to be in charge. We want to call our own shots. I don't want someone telling me what to do. And we know what the Bible calls that. What's the S word? Sin. The Bible calls that sin. That we want to do our... We want to be like God. I want to be in charge. And so this king is coming to bring salvation. He's coming to save us from what is killing us. And that is our selfishness. And so that's one of the marks of this king. Well, he goes on and he's describing a number of things. Well, look at the next line there. He says, humble. Humble. And when we see that word, the word really here, humble would be a translation, but the word really is suffering. This king is going to suffer. Isn't it interesting? So it's even stronger than humble. He's going to be a suffering king. Well, that's not what kings do they? They're wined and dined. They say a word and someone comes in and does something for them, right? Not this king. Not this righteous king. He is going to be a suffering. He is going to suffer. And you know what? As we read through the Old Testament, that shouldn't be a surprise. All of the leaders that God has used in his story have suffered, haven't they? Think back to Joseph. Joseph in Genesis. How did Joseph suffer? He finds himself in prison for what reason? Why was he in prison? Because he would not commit adultery with his boss. I think that would be suffering. Why are you in here? Well, I killed a few people. Why are you in here? Well, I wasn't going to commit adultery with my boss. What are you doing in here? Well, there's probably more going on than what we see. He suffered. Abraham. How did Abraham suffer? All he wanted was a child, or two, or three. It starts with one. God promised him that he'd be a father of a nation. And it would take 25 years before he would be holding a baby in his hand. 25 years. Yeah, you could describe that as suffering. And you remember his story, sometimes that he tried to rush things along. Right? God doesn't know what he's doing. I better help him here. And so suffering. And we could go on, all the Old Testament, example after example, suffering. So one of the things that we see, suffering is part of righteousness, right? This king is not going to take the short way. He's not going to say, you know what? I'm beyond suffering. No, he is going to suffer. It's going to be one of the marks. How are you going to know this righteous king? He's going to suffer unbelievably. And so if we're to be honest, I think in our own lives, if you're going to follow Jesus, Scripture says you're going to suffer. And so if you think you're going to follow Jesus and have a nice, comfortable journey, you're not reading this book. And you're definitely not following the Jesus of the Bible. Because he suffered. And so we're going to suffer as well. And so don't think for a moment when you're suffering, you're getting it wrong. Now you could. You might be suffering because you made some dumb mistakes. Okay? So that's part of the package too. Don't think, well, I'm suffering. And well, maybe you're suffering because you've been foolish. So you got to discern that and weigh that. But you think about that, even in my own life, you know, as a leader, there have been some seasons where, you know, what has been my area where I have felt the pain? It's been more in the emotional arena. I'm a pretty driven person, but there's times in my life where I have no drive to get out of bed. Emotions. God zaps everything out. Suffering can look in all kinds of different ways. How is God calling? Where is God helping you to understand what Christ is like and that he suffered? He suffered. Look back to Zechariah chapter 9. This king he's going to be righteous and bring salvation. He is going to suffer. And now we can see a very real, tangible, physical sign that you're going to say, ooh, this is the promised one. And so what does he say? Mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So how are you going to know who this righteous king is? He's going to be on a donkey. And so part of the point here, a donkey was a symbol of peace. A horse was a symbol of war. And so this king is going to enter Jerusalem offering peace. Offering peace. But what's behind this verse historically? And again, if the listeners of this from Zechariah, the Jews of that time, would understand what was going on. Now, we don't get it, so I'm going to bring us into what is going on. And you're going to have to turn back to 1 Kings chapter 1. 1 Kings chapter 1. And again, my opening there talking about brothers. 1 Kings chapter 1. King David had many sons. He's close to dying. He's old. He can't keep himself warm anymore. His life is almost over. And what's the natural thing? Who takes over the throne? You know, who takes over the throne? Which one? The oldest, right? The oldest gets all the oldest one should be the one who next one in charge, firstborn. But one of the things that we see in God's economy, God doesn't do it our way. God said that Solomon would be the next king that would go after David. But Solomon's older brother is Adonijah. Maybe I'm not saying it right. And he says, hey, I'm the older brother, I'm in charge. And so look at the story here, and we'll see. You'll get this. 1 Kings 1, verses 5 through 7 says this. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be the king. And he prepared himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done thus and so? So what is he saying here? David was a man after God's own heart, but he wasn't the greatest dad in the world. He was unwilling to challenge his sons when they were doing things wrong. And so David wasn't perfect either. And that's what he's basically saying here. When, you know, you've read through this, he's unwilling to tell Absalom, stop it. And so we see that, and that's what's being carried out here. Second part of verse 6, he was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom, which basically he's just given the idea here that Adonijah is older than Solomon. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and Abithar the priest, and they followed Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada and Nathan the prophet and Shimei and Re and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. And so we see this struggle here within the house, and Adonijah puts himself forward. And David is old. He doesn't even really kind of know what's going on. And so look what happens next. Look down in verse 28. There's more going on to the story, so you can go back and read it later if you would like, but I'm just getting to the point here. Then King David answered, "Call Bathsheba to me." So she came into the king's presence and stood before the king, and the king swore, saying, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, as I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, even so will I do this day." Then Bathsheba bowed with her face to the ground and paid homage to the king and said, "May my lord King David live forever." King David said, "Call to me Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada." And so we can't see this here, but I think we know the priest. We know the prophet. Who is Benaiah? Well, Benaiah is, he's one of David's mighty men. He's a secret service guy. Like, he's the one who, "I need something done, go take him out." And you can read through the story here. He's kind of the Navy SEAL. He's the, for our day. And so he identifies him, and he has some pretty important things. He's a warrior. Verse 33, here's the key verse. And the king said to them, "Take with you the servants of your Lord and have Solomon, my son, ride on my own," what does he say? "Mule, and bring him down to Gihon." So David says, "You take my mule, and you put Solomon on my mule and let him ride into the city." Because who rides on the king's mule? It's not a trick question. Who rides on the king's mule? The king. Who rides on Air Force One? The president does. And so part of this process, David says, "You take my mule and you ride." It was a symbol. He is the next king. Look down at verse 38. So did Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Cherethites and the Pelethites went down and had Solomon ride on King David's mule and brought him to Gihon. There Zadok the priest took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. Then they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, "Long live King Solomon." And all the people went up after him, playing on pipes and rejoicing with great joy, so that the earth was split by their noise. And so what do we see here? Riding the king's mule was a symbol of the next king that would be anointed. And that's the backdrop of what Zechariah is prophesying. There's going to be another king who is going to enter Jerusalem. It'll be 500 years later, and we looked at that, and you can go back and in your spillover, you know, passages when you know this week, you can go back and look at some of those passages, and you can see that. But going back to what Zechariah is saying here, when they heard these words, that's what they would remember. Oh, yeah, this isn't the first time this happened. But this king is going to be different than David and Solomon and every other king, because this king is going to be righteous. He's going to be the only righteous king. And so I think as we look at this, think about Christ. I think one of the questions of application we have to ask ourselves is, how do we respond to authority? A king deserves submission, right? Well, maybe. That's what some of you are thinking. The answer is yes. Well, it depends. If he's a good king, we'll give our submission. But if he's a bad king, then we shouldn't. But one of the things that we see is, how do we respond to authority? For many years of my own life, I struggled with authorities in my own life. My last church that I was at, me and the senior pastor had our differences. And one of the things, I didn't see it until I came here, because I noticed all the things that he didn't do right, all the ways that he didn't treat me the way I thought I should be treated. And I struggled with authority in my life. And you know where it went back to? It went back to the wound that I had from my father. Because there's things that my dad did or didn't do that created insecurities, anger, that all of a sudden was put on other people. Because authority is something that is very important. And it's important for our day. And so fast forward to 1 Peter. We're going to look at one couple verses here as we think about Jesus the King. Peter watched him. Listen, I'm just going to read down through these verses. 1 Peter 2. And just listen here to Peter's perspective and how we as believers in Jesus Christ are to respond to authority. God's authority, but also the other authorities in our life. Verse 13, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme. And by the way, who was the emperor that was in charge while Peter is writing? Nero. A horrific, evil dictator. And what is Peter saying? Submit to the authorities in your life. And so that's what these listeners are hearing. Verse 14, or to the governor as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Verse 14, here's four commands. Honor everyone. Why? Because there's an authority in our relationships with one another. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect. Or to put it in our terms, employees, be subject to your bosses. Be subject to them. Not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. God, that doesn't sound... that's hard. Yeah. In fact, you can't do it. Only through Jesus Christ and surrendering to him. Verse 19, for this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. You know why Jesus Christ is the only King of Kings? Because when he walked on this planet Earth, he showed us what living under the authorities of God, but also the authorities in this world, looks like. And that's a hard thing. That's why he is worthy of our worship. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up and We're going to sing a song and then prepare to take the Lord's table in a moment. And so I think here, as we're being mindful of the King that we worship, the King that we serve, the King that one day every human being on this planet will see him for who he really is.